Studio 360.
You've probably heard of the Hollywood 10. These 10 left-wing screenwriters and directors who were accused of being dangerous commie subversives by the House Committee investigating Hollywood liberals and left-wingers in the late 1940s, before McCarthyism was even called that. These 10 appeared before the committee very uncooperatively. The most famous were Dalton Trumbo and Ring Lardner Jr. Another one was a director named Herbert Biberman.
It is perfectly clear to me, gentlemen, that if you continue in this particular
Mr. Chairman,
fashion,
will you direct the witness
to answer
that
question?
Like the others in the Hollywood 10, Biberman was convicted of contempt of Congress and served 6 months in prison. And then he got out. And despite being blacklisted, he made a movie financed independently, along with fellow blacklistees, including Will Gear, who 20 years later showed up on TV as Grandpa on The Waltons. It was this brazenly, defiantly left-wing movie called Salt of the Earth. Its story drawn from a real-life strike by Mexican-American miners that had just taken place. Latino USA producer Sayer Quevedo went to Grant County, New Mexico to track down the details of that based on a true life history.
How shall I begin my story that has no beginning?
This is Esperanza.
Esperanza Quintero.
She's a housewife in New Mexico, living in a small town.
When I was a child, it was called San Marcos. The Anglos changed the name to Zinktown. Zinktown, New Mexico, USA.
The image is black and white. Dusty roads, clothes swaying on laundry lines in the desert wind, shacks with corrugated tin roofs.
Our roots go deep in this place, deeper than the pines, deeper than the mine shafts.
Zinktown is owned by a mining company. All the land, all the houses, it all belongs to the company.
I am a miner's wife. 18 years my husband has given to that mine, living half his life with dynamite and darkness.
This is how the film Salt of the Earth begins. It's a portrait of a desolate place dominated by mining and by injustice. Mexicans in town don't have running water in their homes, while Anglos, as the Mexicans call them, do. Mexicans are more likely to be killed in the mines because they're required to work alone, but Anglos are allowed to work in pairs. And Mexicans are constantly put down by their bosses and treated like dirt. On this day, Ramon, Esperanza's husband, is considering whether to go on strike with the other Mexican-American miners. They want to demand equal pay and safer working conditions. What happens next in this small New Mexico mining town is not just the plot of a dramatic film. It's real. The miners, the discrimination, the dangerous working conditions, and the strike. They're all based on a true story. Before I tell you about what things are like in Grant County now, I'm going to tell you the story of how things used to be. And we're going to start with Arturo Flores. He was an important figure in the Empire Zinc strikes.
Hi. Please come in.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, how's it going?
It's my dad, Arthur Flores. He's 100 years old.
Hello.
One of the first presidents of Local 890.
The Local 890 is the name of the miners' union in Grant County, by the way. We're going to hear about it a lot. And Arturo Flores was a union leader there in the 1950s.
I have the originals.
Do not hear.
It's okay. I have.
Okay. However, I have no problem with talking. I made it over 100. I'm supposed to be dumb.
You seem like you're doing just fine.
Let me just show you what we have.
Arturo sits in a wheelchair. His thin silver hair is neatly combed. His son, Larry, lays out a set of old photographs on the table.
Here's Dad, and here's some of the actors from the movie, Clinton.
Men walking out of the union hall. Women in flannels and big-brimmed hats, smiling triumphantly at the camera. There's Arturo. He has a full head of thick black hair. The photo is labeled Local 890 Activists, 1953. I've come here to speak with Arturo because he is, as far as I can tell, one of the oldest living witnesses of the Empire's ink strikes. Since Arturo can't hear that well, I write questions down on a piece of paper and hold them up for him to read. Arturo tells me about his childhood in Grant County. The place in the movie, Zinktown, isn't real, but the county is dotted with little mining towns. Arturo's dad worked in the mines, his mother was a homemaker, and Arturo was a smart kid. He loved to read.
Before I was 12, I had read the Bible 3 times. I could read, I like to read so much.
Arturo tells me the story about a countywide history competition when he was in 6th grade. He made it to the very last round and then lost.
The teacher was very sad, came to me, and she said, "You won, but you didn't get it to number one because it said they can't give it to a Mexican. That's the policy of the company, and they were hired by the company. The company at that time had a policy that Mexicans were treated differently."
Mexicans were treated differently, he says. And the company Arturo is referring to is one of several companies that owned mines across Grant County. A historian, Ellen R. Baker, wrote a book about all of this called On Strike and On Film, and she explained just how much power the mining companies had. They owned the land and houses in some towns, and in other cases, actually owned whole towns themselves, which meant they could discriminate all they wanted.
The company had houses for the Anglos and shacks for the Mexicans.
Whole towns were divided, white people, or Anglos as they called them, on one side, and Mexicans on the other. Anglos were given higher paying jobs in the mines, while Mexicans were forced to work underground for less. As a young man, Arturo Flores left for the military, and when he came back, he started working at the mine nearby, digging up zinc. The mine was run by the Empire Zinc Company.
When I came back from the service, they treated me terribly. And I said, this is going to change.
Arturo was a member of the miners' union at Empire Zinc Mine. Almost every mine in Grant County had a union. And so there were a lot of little unions, but they didn't work together to negotiate contracts or better working conditions. And their grievances were often ignored by the mining companies. Then, in the late 1940s, something changed. A representative from the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers showed up at Arturo's doorstep. His name was Clinton Jenks. He asked Arturo, "Are you the one who's been complaining?"
I said, "Yes." I said, "We're divided. We have no power. They make fun of us, but we ought to do something." He said, "Yes," he said, "but I need some help."
Arturo worked with the national representative, Jenks, to bring the unions together into a single, more powerful group that would represent all of them. It was called the Local 890. By 1948, 5 of the unions had signed on. They bought an old building in the town of Deming to be their union hall. A couple years later, in 1950, the miners' contracts at Empire Zinc Mine came up for negotiation. This time, the workers demanded a 15-cent raise, 2 more paid holidays, and a change to the payment system that favored white miners. But the company refused to negotiate. That's when the men decided to go on strike. The film Salt of the Earth depicts these true events with a little extra drama.
It's up to you, brothers.
See.
And so it began. Much like any other strike. There would be no settlement, the company said, till the men returned to their jobs.
The men set up a picket line blocking the entrances to the mine. They carried signs. From the surrounding hills, they watched for scabs, miners who were trying to cross the picket line to work.
"Papa, we seen them, 2 scabs over there! They're hiding over there in the gully!"
Empire Zinc Company drove miners from neighboring mines in the county to try to cross the picket line to work. Others chose to come on their own. There's some important context we have to explain here. So remember, this was a time of hysteria about communists, infiltrating Hollywood, the government, and unions. And in 1947, Congress passed this law known as the Taft-Hartley Act. It redefined the relationship between unions and employers. But most importantly for our story, it included this provision requiring all union officers to sign an affidavit, swearing that they weren't communists. And if they didn't, they gave up their union's right to have their grievances heard by the federal government. The Local 890 had refused to sign it, and the company had no intention of compromising with Mexican miners, especially those who might also be communists.
The strike did not end. It went on and on, into the fourth month, the fifth, the sixth. The company still refused to negotiate.
Then, in the eighth month, lawyers from the Empire Zinc Company approached a local judge. Arturo Flores said they took advantage of a loophole.
They went to court and said, the guys are closing the street.
The company said that the strikers should not be allowed to block the road, and the judge ordered the strikers to stop. And because the Local 890 had refused to sign those affidavits promising they weren't communists, they couldn't ask the government to help mediate the dispute. They were stuck.
If we obey the court, the strike will be lost. The scabs will move in as soon as our picket line is gone. If we defy the court, our pickets will be arrested, and the strike will be lost anyway.
What happens next ultimately changed the fate of this strike, turning it from an ordinary event into a historic one.
If you read the court injunction carefully, you will see that it only prohibits striking miners from picketing. We women are not striking miners. We will take over your picket line.
Women had been involved in the strike since day one, but they were often relegated to working behind the scenes, cooking for the strikers, collecting donations, handing out leaflets. They were the wives, sisters, and daughters of the miners. But now they had an idea. They would take over for the men. Those miners were not comfortable with the women's proposal.
And what will happen when the cops come and beat our women up? Are we going to stand there and watch them? No. We'll take over anyway. And we'll be right back where we started. Only worse. Even more humiliated. Brothers. Brothers. I beg you. Don't allow this.
Mostly what shows in the film is the way they acted. Especially the guy who was supposed to have been the leader of the strike.
This is maybe one of the most interesting tensions of the Empire Zinc strike. The people who would have benefited most from having the women take over, the miners, were the ones who were against it. They were embarrassed. They knew that if the women were out blocking the roads, the men would have to stay home and take care of the kids.
Clint asked for a vote of the city instead of just the members so that the women could vote.
Every adult living in town was given a vote, instead of just the union members, who were almost all men.
All those in favor that the sisters take over the picket line will so signify by raising their hand.
Aye!
All those opposed.
Some men silently lifted their hands into the air, but it wasn't enough.
The motion has carried 103-85.
And they voted overwhelmingly to be on the strike.
The women would replace the men on the picket line.
And so they came, the women. They came from Zinc Town and the hills beyond, from other mining camps, 10, 20, 30 miles away. Women we had never seen before. Women who had nothing to do with the strike. Somehow they heard about the women's picket line, and they came.
Meanwhile, the men took over at home.
They had to take care of the house, and they found out that the women worked as hard as they did at on some things.
This sudden change in social hierarchy wasn't easy for the men to handle. In the film, that includes the central couple, Esperanza and Ramon.
Have you learned nothing from this strike?
Why are you afraid to have me at your side? Do you still think you can have dignity only if I have none?
Talk of dignity. After what you've been doing.
Yes, I talk of dignity. The Anglo-bosses look down on you, and you hate them for it. Stay in your place, you dirty Mexican. That's what they tell you. But why must you say to me, stay in your place? Do you feel better having someone lording you?
Shut up, you're talking crazy.
Who's next?
The women understood that they were fighting for more than just the men's jobs. They were fighting to be given respect. And despite the discomfort, the reality was that the men did need the women to win. And the company knew that too. According to the book by Ellen R. Baker, the local sheriff hired a gang of new deputies paid for by the Empire Zinc Company, Their job was to break up scuffles, but mostly they intimidated the women. They would arrive at the picket line and throw tear gas to try and disperse the crowd. They tried to drive their cars through the picket line. And at one point, they even threw the women in jail, along with some of their children. And then, in January 1952, over a year after the strike had begun, the company finally gave in and agreed to negotiate with the miners. They had won, all thanks to the women of Grant County.
So that strike did one thing, as far as I'm concerned. It showed that the women could also get in the fight and be as militant as the men were and win if they had to. And they did.
Thanks to the women, the men were able to go back to work. They received a wage increase, vacation benefits, a pension plan, and a health plan. It wasn't everything they asked for, but the miners also won the confidence that if they worked together, they could be powerful. And soon, the real story of the strike was being turned into a film. Salt of the Earth was shot on location in Grant County, New Mexico, using many of the real miners and their families as actors. Because the writer, producer, and director had all been blacklisted in Hollywood, it wasn't easy to finish the film. When Salt of the Earth was made, the strike scenes were filmed in hidden places, away in the hills where no one could see. Rosaura Revueltas, who played Esperanza, was deported to Mexico before she could even finish shooting her final scenes. And the night after they finished filming, someone tried to burn the Union Hall down. When Salt of the Earth was released in 1954, almost no theater would show it. But in the decades that followed, the film would be embraced by activists for its depiction of workers, Chicanos, and women's empowerment. In 1992, the film was included in the National Film Registry at the Library of Congress, a symbol of its importance to American culture. 2 weeks after I talked with Arturo Flores, the local 890 leader, his son informed me that he had passed away. He was 100 years old. I found myself coming back to the last thing he said to me during the interview.
I've been reading up on history. I like to read history a lot because I think that if you read history, you'll find out how societies advance, how they become powerful, and how they dissolve, and why. You know what dissolves societies? Greed.
Greed, he said, is what dissolves societies. At the end of the Salt of the Earth film, Esperanza looks out triumphantly at the town.
Then I knew we had won something they could never take away. Something I could leave to my children, and they, the salt of the earth, would inherit it.
The miners' victory, she seems to say, will mean a better life for future generations.
That's producer Saya Cavedo. To hear more about the legacies of both the film and the strike in Grant County, you can hear Sayer's full story at latinousa.org.